Welcome back to our podcast, Explain It Like MAI, Decoding AI Without Panic, Beyond Hype. In this space, we explore how artificial intelligence is transforming our world, from the way we work and communicate to how we think, learn, and create. Our goal is to move beyond fear and blind optimism, offering a balanced perspective that highlights both promises and risks of these technologies. Each episode takes a closer look at a key dimension of AI, helping you build a clear and critical understanding of how it works and what it means for society today.
Welcome to the first episode of Explain It Like I'm AI, Decoding AI Without Panic, Beyond Hype. I'm Lorenzo Luccioli, PhD student in mathematics.
And I'm Virginia Fidenti, PhD student in economic policy.
And we're here today with Paolo Torroni and Andrea Galassi, professors at the Department of Computer Science and Engineering in the University of Bologna, where they work in the field of artificial intelligence and natural language processing. So, to start with this topic of AI, we thought it would be useful to give a quick glance at the history of the field, because it seems to me that this field of AI has been introduced to the general public just a few years ago, especially with the advent of ChatGPT. So I think it may seem to a lot of people that the field itself is somehow new, and maybe it's only just a few years since it started, but well, we know that's not really the case, that has quite a long history actually. So could you give us some points of this history with maybe even some examples of AI systems? We think that this may also help disambiguate between the terms that are used, for example, the difference between artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, and large language models.
Okay, hi everybody, thank you for inviting me to this exciting podcast. Everybody's talking about AI now, and I'm happy to be here to tell you that actually it is not a very new thing, but it's been around for many decades, although it followed an alternating history of successes and disappointments. So now we are in the middle of a spring of AI, where we see great successes of AI, and this comes together with many hopes and maybe also many exaggerated hopes. But some successes of AI were already several decades ago. For example, if you think of Deep Blue, the famous computer program that managed to win against the world champion of chess. That's one example of an AI system built with completely different technologies from what you see today. And less than 10 years ago, another important AI system that went in the news was AlphaGo, a system that won against the world champion of Go, an even more challenging game. So these are examples of AI systems from the past, maybe recent past or even far away. Today we got entirely different systems, but the history didn't start yesterday, let's say.
So you mentioned Deep Blue as an AI system, but can we say that Deep Blue is also a machine learning system or a deep learning system or an LLM?
So since you mentioned LLMs, nowadays people tend to identify artificial intelligence with LLMs, simply because that's what people talk about, and there is also a strong commercial interest in selling LLMs as AI or selling anything as AI nowadays. But in fact, LLMs are simply a technology that is used for some specific applications, and AI is much more than that. AI is about being able to solve complicated problems using smart methodologies that are either on par with what humans would do when they solve problems, but at a much larger scale, or they are completely independent of how a human would do. But they are able anyway to solve problems that are complex themselves. And that's why they are called intelligent, and they are artificial because humans are not involved typically in that.
So up until now, we've mentioned many types of AI systems. Could you maybe expand on the distinction between the main categories of AI tools that people encounter nowadays in practice? Well, like we thought of prediction, classification, generative AI. So could you expand on this?
Sure. The main categories of AI systems are system based on knowledge and system based on data. Data-driven systems. In the first case, you use what you know about the problem that you have to solve in order to encode some rules or some recipes, some algorithms that are smart in some ways, and proceed with your solution. So the second type of AI is based on the data. So the idea of machine learning is being able to learn how to behave based on examples that you see, and if you know which examples represent examples to follow, good examples, and which other examples are things not to do, then you can learn to discriminate between these two different things. You can learn to predict what will happen next. You learn to distinguish between different categories of objects. For example, you can learn how to distinguish between people. If your idea is to develop systems that can discriminate between adults and children, for example. So by looking at examples of adults and children, you can learn from images of such people to discriminate.
Yeah. We have mentioned already how AI system can predict, can classify, or in some cases generate information. And we already mentioned this buzzword, but I think it's time now to face it. What does it mean that AI is learning? So I think it's now at the moment when we dig into that as well. What does it mean for an AI system to learn, and in which ways, how do they learn?
Hi, thank you for having me here. So when we talk about learning, we can, first of all, distinguish three main paradigms. One is supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and reinforcement learning. And these are the three, let's say, big families of learning. And then each of these family has its own method, and some methods can belong in multiple families. When we talk about supervised learning, we are talking about having examples with labels from which our model can learn. So the model looks at the data and looks at the label. The label it must learn, and learns the connection between the data and the label. In unsupervised learning, instead, we have data, but we don't have labels. So what the artificial intelligence method, machine learning method, try to do is to find the patterns. Try to find patterns in this data without knowing what that patterns indicate, what is the semantic of the patterns, but just to distinguish different data. And then there is a reinforcement learning. In reinforcement learning, instead, we don't have data, but the system tries to do something, and depending on how it goes, if it goes well or it goes bad, receive a feedback, a reward or a punishment, and based on that, it learns something and then tries again and so on and so on. And it can do this in the real world or in a simulated environment. Whether we use one paradigm or the other depends on the situation we are in. Obviously, for example, for supervised learning is the one where we have many information, and so we need a lot of information. We need to have this data, we need to have the labels, and this is typically very costly because it means that there is someone, some humans or some other system that has gathered those data and has assigned a meaning to each of these data. But it is also, it has been for a long time, one of the techniques that produced the best results, because it's the one where there is more knowledge, and that knowledge is given to the model. In unsupervised learning, instead, we have the data, but we don't have the label. So we can learn patterns, but it's up to the humans then to, in some way, to assign a meaning to this different kind of data. In reinforcement learning, instead, we don't need the data, but what we need is to be able to evaluate the behavior of the model. An example is our robots that try to stand up on their legs. And so when they manage, they receive a reward. When they fail, they receive a punishment. An important thing about reinforcement learning is that a model learns from the consequence of their action. While in the other, in supervised learning, for example, the model learns a correlation between how the data looks like and the label assigned to it, doesn't have the concept of a consequence. Instead, in reinforcement learning, the model tries to do something that the action has an effect in a real environment or a simulated environment, and based on the consequence, it receives a feedback. To give a somehow intuitive example, Think about how you learn to play a game. Either you can receive the instructions, so you read the instructions and you look at the board and you know that in that moment this player is winning or another player is winning, and this goes somehow in the direction of supervised learning. Or no one tells you the instructions and you just look at other players playing, I don't know, chess, and you have to understand what's going on. And you see that in some cases there are a lot of white pieces on the board, in other moments there are a lot of black pieces on the board, and you try to separate in your mind what's going on. And then reinforcement learning, where you actually try to play chess, and you have a teacher that tells you, yes, no, that's a nice move, that could have been better, and so on. In doing that, you learn, let's say, by doing what's going on.
Thank you very much. So while you were talking, I connected it with what we said before. I don't think if that's correct, you will tell me. So for instance, supervised learning, it's something that could be having the labels of adults and children, giving them to the machine, whatever, so that they could connect the images with the actual label of children and adults and learn what is which, right?
Yeah, exactly. That is a case of supervised learning. Instead, if you just give the picture and you don't tell what is what and the system has only to separate somehow, it will be up to the system to find a criterion with which they separate the picture. Maybe it will separate based on the height, and so maybe it will be more or less able to separate children and adults. But maybe we'll choose, I don't know, to separate them based on the color of the hair. And in that case, you will learn something completely different. I throw here something that maybe we can talk about later. We don't have full control often on what the system learns. The system will learn from the data, but we don't know which elements of the data they learn from. And that's sometimes have led to several problems, but maybe we can talk about it a bit later.
I think it's very interesting that, Andrea, you made an analogy with how humans actually learn. Because, I mean, from the point that we start talking about AIs as learning agents, we're already making an analogy with learning as humans or as animals learn. So do you think this analogy that I think will come up other times, also so with other words that are used both about humans and about AIs, do you think this analogy is actually useful for understanding the field, or do you think it may lead to misconceptions about it?
Here we go a bit more in philosophy, I think, than technical questions, but a great question. It is something that researchers have asked themselves for a long time. Does artificial intelligence mean to create something that resembles humans, like the human intelligence, or is something that goes in a different direction? If we create something that seems to be able to reason and produce intelligent behavior, but is different from how a human would do it, is it artificial intelligence? Should we evaluate artificial intelligence based on humans? Or should we be more open? And in that case, how do we evaluate what is intelligence? So I don't have an answer to these questions. So it's very natural for us as human beings to, let's say, project on model system the behavior that we think the human behavior. If I see something that does actions that resemble human action, I will project on that thing the fact that those actions were made for the same reason I would have made it. But that's not always the case. If I, talking about LLMs, or in general, many of the modern models that seem to have a human-like behavior or a human-like interaction, because since we are an empathetic species, I may project on this object the expectation that what I'm interacting with has some human characteristics. If I receive a certain answer, I will imagine that there is a human-like reasoning behind it. While that is not always the case, I mean, there have been several researchers that have shown that modern systems don't have an ability to actually reason or to use logic, but they simply mimic the language of humans. I mean, it's an ongoing research, and there is continuous development in this direction. There have been improvement, but if, for example, interacting with an LLM, it gives an answer that seems to be logical and have a reasoning behind it, it doesn't necessarily mean there is that kind of reasoning. This is because when we learn, this system has been created learning from a lot of data. But this learning is not mapped into a knowledge that humans can investigate. So there isn't a logical or a reasoning behind these models. And therefore, we cannot follow what are the steps that they take to produce the final answer. Modern systems that are now called reasoning models follow, let's say, some sort of guidelines, guided path to create their answer, but still is not a formal logical reasoning. It's more of a brainstorming with themselves and asking themselves questions so they can create a bit of a more structured and logical answer.
So I believe that the analogies with the concepts that we attribute to humans, behaviors that we attribute to humans, is not wrong in itself. And it can be useful, actually. For example, the idea of attributing some intentional stance to objects or to computers or to items, even as simple as the light switch, even thinking of a light switch as something with an intention. So if you touch it, then it wants to turn on the light. It is not something that is bad in itself or brings you out of the way of understanding how these things work. It's just a way of thinking of things. So also in AI systems, it is very natural to think about them as learning in the same way as we think of learning, humans learning. A reason is that the technologies behind computer learning were inspired to the way humans learn. So the inspiration is the same. We can say that we learn by experience as humans. We can say that we can learn by being taught things, by being given rewards. So there are analogies for sure. So it may be useful to think of artificial systems in the same way, using the same mental categories that we use to think about people. This does not mean that we should believe they are constructed in the same way, they replicate the same mechanisms of learning, that they learn in the same way. So there is a difference, I think, between an analogy with how humans learn, which from the technological viewpoint, from the biological viewpoint, maybe is wrong because we don't actually know, we don't really know many things about how machine learning systems get to behave in some way, so what they learn, how they learned. But it is also true we don't know it about humans either. So there are many things we don't know about how humans reason, how humans learn. So the general idea of thinking about AI systems using human categories, I think, is not wrong. As far as we are aware that artificial intelligence systems are not a replication of humans. They are different systems that we can describe as systems that learn and that act in way as humans would do, but we don't really know how they do that in a way.
Thank you very much for the contribution. I think it's very interesting this philosophical turn that the conversation has taken. So we also talked about the reasoning of these models and how maybe underneath the surface there's not the same reasoning as humans, but maybe another point can be made in this regard, that also humans underneath the surface, so for example inside our brains, we only have very simple operations going on, for example neurons and neural activations. Could this maybe, these new turns in AI that manage to reproduce some of the outcomes of neurons, which is human activity, be used also to rethink about how humans think, what it means for humans to think and reason?
This is a big question. I am not sure if I would take it that far. Maybe sometimes when we develop machine learning methods and we see that they work in some way, this may give us some ideas about how other biological systems work. I'm not sure if I would push the analogy that far. It is true that like both humans and computers are made of simple elements. So we are made of matter and atoms and molecules, and the computers also work with binary code and digits and electrical stimuli, the same as humans. So if you look at the matter is the same, essentially. So it makes a lot of sense to think that reasoning itself is built on top of very simple mechanisms in both cases. in the case of humans, for example, reasoning can be thought of as an effect of evolution. Reasoning is a skill that has been acquired by evolution in order to fit better to the environment. So you learn how to reason in order to better understand the information you get from the environment. You learn to argue in order to convince other people to do what you want them to do. So reasoning is something that evolution encourages, in a way. In the case of computers, maybe we can think of reasoning also at some point as something that may develop as an ability. What I would like to make it clear now is that although this is a good maybe idea as a pathway for the future, today we are not there. So today when we talk about reasoning in AI, we are talking about, with the same term, about two very different things. The classical AI systems consider reasoning in a very specific way, in a very formal way, where reasoning is a symbolic manipulation of concepts. What does this mean? This means that you have a representation of your problem, of your domain, of the world in which you live. And by reasoning, you draw conclusions, you make inferences, you start from the elements that you have in order to make conclusions that are logically valid, logically coherent. With this mechanism, you can solve very complex problems because you can do it at scale. So reasoning in artificial intelligence until recently has always been formal reasoning, symbolic reasoning, logically correct reasoning, made possible by the application of rules and the application of reasoning procedures that are encoded very clearly. In recent years, reasoning instead in artificial intelligence and specifically in large language models has been used in a different way from the past to indicate the impression, let's say, or the feeling of the illusion, maybe, the illusion of expressing concepts that would be linked in the same way as humans link concepts when they speak. But there is nothing formal behind, there is nothing logical behind, there is a simple pattern matching mechanism that links elements of text or elements of images or elements of audio, depends, I mean, of what kind of output is given by these models, which makes sense when you look at it, but underneath is not the same reasoning as we described before. So these are two very different things.
Thank you so much for this insight. I think at this point I need to ask a question, probably not very brilliant. We heard some people call AI machine learning just a stochastic parrot. What do you think about this? Can you give your stand on this?
It's a good question. Actually, stochastic parrots is a very evocative phrase that has been, I think, invented by some researchers at Google, if I remember well. Large language models tend to give the impression that they know what they're talking about. And the reason for that is that they are built specifically with that intention. So they're built to be persuasive, to be fluent in English, to imitate the ways humans would speak. And therefore, when you interact with the system like an LLM, then if the LLM is good, if you like that you're speaking with somebody that knows what they're talking about. But in fact, the LLM doesn't have behind anything of what makes us speak. So to show the difference between fluency, persuasiveness, and knowing what you're talking about, the term stochastic parrots, the phrase stochastic parrots, in a way highlights the fact that the LLMs repeats in a stochastic way what the LLM has already seen, has already heard, has already found before. But under the hood, there is no intentional stand. Behind the hood, there is not a communicative intent, let's say. So there is a stochastic behavior that repeats something similar to what has been seen before. One interesting thing is the term stochastic, which brings to the concept that the way large language models are trained is by looking for correlations, making statistics on the text, looking for correlations in the text. And this is very different from being able to learn causality. The idea of why I'm saying something, the intention of saying something because of a reason, and the causal relation between what happens in the world and what I should say, for example, or the relation between the reasons for something and their effects. So this is completely lost in LLM, because LLM is not trained by making experiences on the world. The LLM is trained by looking at data only. And this is a fundamental difference with the way humans communicate, because the communication of humans is a result of experience made on the world. So there is some intention behind, because behind there is a notion of a connection between causes and effects. But in the case of LLMs, there are only correlations. That's why we talk about stochastic bias in that sense.
Yeah, I don't know if it clarifies or makes things more confused, but imagine a baby like 1 year, 2 years, that is learning to speak, and the parents show an apple and a banana, and they say apple, and they raise the apple, and they say banana, and they raise the banana, and they keep doing that, and then the baby at some point will try to say apple, and the parent will give them the apple, and maybe they wanted to say banana, but they will learn, oh, if I say apple, this red object arrives. And from that, even if they have not learned the correct thing, then they can rewire, let's say, what they've learned based on the experience they have. That's something that the LLMs don't have. But also I wanted to add another thing, that when we talk about LLMs, there is a bit of ambiguity in the sense that a large language model is a model learned to interact, that is being trained to interact with humans and whatever. But when we use a service such as ChatGPT or Gemini or other services like that, we don't only use an LLM. The core of the system is an LLM, is a model, but all around it there is a ecosystem of other software that interact with that model. So when we are using ChatGPT, we are not only using the ChatGPT LLM, but we are also using a set of other services, of other utilities that the ChatGPT service provides us to make everything work more smoothly.
Thank you so much for clarifying this point. If I can quickly make a comment on this, stay with us with a discussion about socio-political implications of AI during the third episode, because there we are going to discuss the risk of identifying correlation and causality. I think we have explored both learning and reasoning in AI. And it's also interesting to turn to AI system that people actually interact with every day. Every one of us hear about ChatGPT, Claude, Microsoft Copilot. There are plenty. But how different are these systems really? How similar are actually under the hood? And why do we need so many of them?
Okay, so it is true, as we look around, it seems that there are so many LLMs with different names, and one may wonder, do we need all of them? Are they all the same? I think that one simple thing of thinking of the different varieties of LLMs in the market is to compare it with the market of automobiles. So if you want to buy a vehicle, depending on what you need, you would buy a vehicle of a certain brand or another one. You would go for a certain category of car, and the same happens with LLMs. So with the language models, you may have language models that are fit to serve the purpose of computer programmers, so they are good for generating code, for assisting in writing code. There may be other LLMs instead that are specifically tailored for assisting professionals in making decisions, and then they have to be able to read documents and to give answers based on documents. Beside the different skills and abilities that they may may have. There are also other issues. For example, the size of the models also matters. It's been clear now that bigger models perform better, but they're not always necessary. So for some applications, you may actually be okay with a much smaller model that is cheaper. It can be portable in your own personal computer, and you don't need to use cloud services, for example. So that's also another differentiation. And finally, nowadays, we are talking about LLMs everywhere in the world. People actually speak different languages. We must not forget that. So different companies are interested in developing models for different languages. In Europe, there is a strong push for building European LLMs, for example. In China, there is DeepSeek. In the US, there are the language models we all know about. So that's also another reason why there are many. Not everybody is interested in developing models for Italian, for example, but somebody must do that.
Thank you. So a recent trend that many of these LLM providers actually have picked up upon these latest months is that of making an agentic version of their LLM. Some people even went as far as saying that 2025 is the year of agents. And recently, Andrei Karpathy, which is a very famous researcher in AI, said that maybe it's not the year of agents, but we're in the decade of agents. So what does it mean for a model to be agentic? How does it differ from a simple ChatGPT, for example?
Thank you for the question. So first of all, agents have been around for a long time before LLMs. What does it mean when we talk about LLM agents? It means that that system, the LLM, has agency, has the possibility and responsibility of taking decision. It's not only a textual system with which we can interact and ask questions, but it's a system that generating text triggers a series of decisions, trigger a series of action. The text is processed by an ecosystem of software, so several other software systems read what the LLM writes, and based on what the LLM writes, take actions. For example, if the LLM answer book flight London, there is some other software that takes that text and process it and makes a connection with the website of to book a flight to London. So it means to have several software components that interact with each other, and also there can be multiple LLMs that talk with each other and have different functions. For example, there can be an LLM that speaks with us users, and then there is another LLM that instead takes the decision and issues these commands, let's say, to the rest of the ecosystem. So this is more or less what agentic LLM means. And they can have, there can be different level of agency, to the point where an LLM could write the code that is executed. The LLM will not only ask other pieces of software to do something, but can write its own software and then execute that software to do something specifically. That's probably the maximum degree of agency that can be given. Depending on the case and the situation, there can be different levels of this.
So some examples of software that can be written and executed, it sounds a bit scary, but it can be very innocent. Like if you want to draw a plot out of some data that you find on a web page, to draw a plot and say that the sales of cars has increased in the last year, you can start from the data, which is read by the LLM because it's text, it's numbers, but then you want to produce an image. And to produce an image, you can do that using some code, some computer program. So this is an example of why developing code can be useful even to do the most trivial things. But another example of agency, it's an interesting one, is that nowadays LLMs are more and more specialized to take on some responsibilities, even personalities. and they can be put together to have a collaborative behavior. So the example is, it is well known that large language models suffer from problems like hallucinations. So they tend to be very convincing, but you never know if they really are factual when they speak, when they produce the output. What you can do is you can develop a system where there are two LLMs, not just one. And the first one who produces some output, and the second one that has the specific task of fact-checking the output produced by the first one. And they can interact in this way if they are able to interact in the way Andrea was saying, so taking decisions. Then they can have a workflow where if there is some made-up, let's say, content, some hallucination in the first stage, and then some decision is made by the second one, and then the answer is modified, and then it's sent back to the first agent, for example. So this is another illustration.
So you mentioned hallucinations. First of all, I'd like to ask you a clarification on that. So what do you mean by hallucination for those who are listening? And in turn, what are the causes of these kind of limitations of LLMs?
Okay, so hallucinations can be described as the output produced by an LLM that does not correspond to anything real in the information that the LLM has acquired during training. So it creates new facts that don't exist. One typical example is if you ask an LLM to describe a concept that doesn't exist. You make a new concept, you make it up. And the LLM has been trained to be helpful, and it has been trained to give an answer that follows some pattern. Maybe the pattern is not so much about checking if what the LLM tells is grounded on facts, but it is about how the answer is given, it's about how convincing it is, how fluent it is. And therefore, if the language model does not find something to say, it makes up things. It can create new facts, and these are called hallucinations. The reason why this happens, this is possible, is that the product of an LLM is not based on any kind of knowledge based. It's based on some black box way of storing information without structure inside the billions of parameters of an LLM. The LLM has in itself ways to produce text, but these ways to produce text do not start from the knowledge of what is actually true and what is actually not true. And therefore, we have hallucinations. When the model is asked something, it tends to have to say something. It will try to anyway say something, even though there's nothing to say there.
Yeah, consider that these models have been explicitly trained to try to satisfy the user. Let's say they are not very keen to admit when they're wrong. So they will try to defend their answer as long as they can, because they've been trained to, especially in the commercial versions, to satisfy the user and to demonstrate they're helpful and demonstrate they don't make errors. So there are examples where they actually deny the errors they've made. These has also is dangerous, obviously, on the single interaction that a person can have with them. There are also larger consequences in terms of the entire, let's say, ecosystem of internet, especially where we have more and more content generated, let's say, assisted or almost completely by LLMs. And so there are also more and more hallucinations around, both in terms of images, but also on text, also facts that are not entirely true or they are completely false. And since new models are trained on the data available online, so there is some sort of feedback loop where there is the risk that new models learn from the mistakes of previous model. And so we reinforce this kind of hallucination. Also, this also has a consequence on humans, because a human exposed to a lot of, if we have several models that create content that contains false information, there is such a spread of this information, this false information, that also humans will start to believe in it. We are already seeing it in the way we use language. As you were probably aware or experiment, LLM tend to have their own way of speaking. Their lexicon, they tend to use certain words more. They used to structure sentences in a certain way, which is sometimes recognizable. And with the fact that more and more people are using LLMs to generate content, especially, for example, non-native English speaker to create English content, there is more and more of this way of speaking online. And then people that, for example, once again, non-native English speaker, learn from this pattern. And they see around them people speaking in that way, and they learn to use the same word. And so I'm not saying we are there, but we are on the steps of going in a paradox where humans learn to speak like the machine speak. This technology, like any other human invention or discovery, is a tool, and it's a powerful but also potentially dangerous. And in the same way you would not light a fire in the center of your living room, but you would light it in your fireplace where it is under control. Similarly, artificial intelligence should be used in a, let's say, responsible way.
I think it is very significant that a couple of days ago, at the end of October, ChatGPT stopped giving services as advices for legal, medical or financial services. So it is starting to recognize limits and, let's say, implement safeguards against behavior that may become liable from
Arming humans, let's say, in the general.
Arming humans in general, but it can also make the system liable to damages, for example, according to European regulations in general. So
lawsuits and so on.
Yeah, this makes it very clear that there is a big difference between expert advice and the output of an LLM. So I think this is a very important thing to keep in mind.
Wow, so these models seem to be very overconfident sometimes, and it seems like we are managing to put up some guardrails to limit them, but the ones you mentioned for a moment, it seems like they are just a way of cutting off all those answers that are somehow about dangerous subjects. Are there also ways to compel the model, for example, to say, I don't know, to say that he's uncertain about something and to encourage it to say only things he's confident about, maybe even in sensible settings. We may want, for example, a model that gives us, for example, medical advice if it's actually certain about that medical advice, if we can be more confident that it's also going to be not an hallucinated answer.
That's a big question. I'd like to think that knowing our own limits is a sign of deep knowledge. When you say, I know that I don't know, and you know that you don't know, it's something that is not obvious. And LLMs are not better than humans, so it's difficult for us to know what we don't know, for an LLM to realize that they don't know what they're talking about. I mean, it's really something complicated. Having said that, there are definitely methods for improving the behavior of LLMs in the sense of making them more aligned with the way we would like them to behave. So this is called actually alignment in LLM technology, alignment to human values, where the values are typically avoiding toxic communication, reducing bias, trying to use gender-neutral terms when possible, trying to admit if you're not sure about that, although it's not easy. These alignment methods are based on the reward mechanisms that Andrea was talking about before. So the LLM in itself would behave as a stochastic parrot, and it would be equally possible for an LLM to answer in a toxic way to a user or in a polite way to a user. given some training. If we can reward, the model gives a type of answer that we prefer because it's more aligned to our values. So if we teach the model preferences by rewarding or punishing the model, then we can drive the behavior of the model in a better way. So a lot of research is going in this direction of alignment of models to human values.
Yeah, it depends a lot on what are the priorities of the people that make that model. I mean, if there is obviously a technological limit, but also depends if I want to create a model that is always anxious to satisfy the user and give an answer, or instead I want a model that is more, let's say, self-aware and is capable of admitting that. Those are very different priorities for, I would say, different markets also.
Okay, thank you so much. I think we have mentioned a lot of things, many insights, and now I would say we can approach the conclusion. To bring this home, apart from highly specialized professional use, for example, in medicine, can you tell us what practical areas can listeners reliably use AI in daily lives? And also, in which other areas should people be cautious using AI, using this kind of technology?
One thing I would like to add is that we tend to associate LLMs to humans also to the extent that we give a personality to LLMs. So as if the LLM was wanting to please you or wanting to behave in some way. In the world when we interact with the humans, everybody is different. So maybe you can find somebody who is more shy or more aware of their own limitations. Maybe you can find somebody else who does not admit mistakes. So we are all different. When we interact with LLMs, we tend to require from them the perfect behavior. There is no perfect behavior because it also depends on the situation. People are different, and also LLMs, in a way, could be different. But different from people, the LLM is only one. When you talk with ChatGPT, that's the LLM that you have in front. Either you talk with that system, or I am talking with the system, or somebody else. In the world they're talking to, with that system, it's always the same system. So having perfection or, you know, the best possible behavior, one size fits all, let's say, behavior is also very difficult. So there will always be things that are not the way you like. Maybe it is too apologetic, maybe it's not enough apologetic. Maybe it's too kind, maybe it's not kind enough. Maybe the answers are too long, maybe they're not long enough. So one thing that we are seeing recently is the idea of making LLMs able to impersonate profiles. So more and more we see users interacting with an LLM by saying, you are a second school teacher, so explain this thing in simple terms. Or for the case of hallucinations, we give explicit instructions to the LLM and say, what is the solution to this problem? If you don't know the answer, say nothing, say I don't know. So also give instructions in order to tell explicitly the LLM which behavior we want is something that is becoming more and more popular now.
That's a big question. So I would say that, first of all, always be a bit cautious in using this kind of technology. For example, it's great to get a lot of information about something at the same time. It can be easier to just ask one of these services to get you all the information on a topic rather than going finding different websites that have that topic. Then there is a, let's say, ethical and economical topic about whether this is sustainable or not. But getting to the point. So that's a way of gathering a lot of information, but that information should be double or triple checked to be sure it's correct. Something that we have seen that models are really good is, for example, at coding standard things. For example, if I need the code, the software code, to do something simple, something standard, something that I can think other thousands of people have asked the internet before me, this kind of system will be probably capable of generating that code for you. And that goes, for example, for generating graphs. If I want to generate some graphics that are not particularly artistic or they do not require certain inventive, I can ask a system to generate graphs based on my data or generate some simple code. For example, sometimes I use it with Excel. I often use it to know which formula should I use to have a certain behavior. So yeah, that's probably a direction where it's kind of safe to use. Always double check, because you never know when the model is going to hallucinate and invent some numbers. But that is probably one of the environments where they are the best. For very specialized profession, obviously, I will say maybe not.
Well, let me say something first of all, that AI and LLMs are different things. So LLMs are one type of AI, but AI has been there for ages, and there are many robust and secure products of AI that are used every day. Just to give you one example, all the production of computer chips in the world goes through formal verification of their correctness before going to production using AI methods. And these are correct methods, reliable methods, and without them it would be impossible to have computers as we know them today. Planning of trips, airplane, hospital scheduling. A lot of applications nowadays are based on AI as we know it traditionally. So AI is there and it's reliable and it's used. Recent innovations of LLMs is still young, so there are still some risks, let's say, in using things that we don't understand entirely yet, and that's why we need to use caution. However, I would say that there are some ways in which LLMs are used that make them very useful for example, consulting technical manuals, asking questions about documentations that you don't have time to read, without being too much exposed to hallucination, insofar as you ask also the system to give you evidence of where the answer was taken from. So now there is this very popular method of that is called the retrieval augmented generation, RAG systems. What they do essentially, they ask an LLM to verbalize the answer to a question, to say it fluently, essentially, but while taking it from documents, from some documents that are given to the system. So the answer is based on facts, it's not based on hallucination, because the LLM is given already the context from where they can take the answer. This is an example of a type of system that can be used relatively safely and where there is a lot of research now going on in many applications. So there are already applications for that can be reliable to some extent. But we must also be aware of the limitations of the systems. So if we want to use them as consultants or advisors without any specific link to evidence, to text, to documents, then we must really be aware that they may hallucinate and tell us things that just are not true.
As a rule of thumb, I would say that if the task, the job is kind of boring for a human, doesn't require a specialized knowledge, and is repetitive, that's a good candidate for an LLM, I would say.
Thank you so much, Paolo and Andrea, for sharing your thoughts with us. It's been a very interesting and inspiring conversation. Thank you also to Bologna University Press, to Collegio Superiore, and to Kine for helping us develop the podcast and host it. And also thank you to everyone listening. Remember to also listen to the next episode, where we'll dig into how AI is changing science, the arts, and also everyday life.
Thank you very much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a great experience. Thank you. Thank you very much.